What happened to music that meant something?
The Who at the Kingdom or Kiss at the Coliseum. Where is the Misty Mountain Hop? Where is the Smoke on the Water? Where is the Iron Man of today?
Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I are going to welcome the stars of the hit movie Once.
Plus, it's Greg's turn to add a track to the Desert Island Jukebox. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
Interesting proposal from Canada, Jim. The Songwriters Association of Canada is proposing essentially a digital tax on music file sharing in Canada. They're talking about adding a $5 monthly fee for every wireless and internet account in the country and then distributing this money to songwriters to compensate them for the massive internet file sharing that's going on right now. We're talking about 50 billion files being shared every year. This proposal puts some money on the table. It is designed to raise about $1 billion a year, which would then be distributed to songwriters and bands for the music that they're putting out.
It's by far, Greg, I think, one of the most sensible proposals we've heard about. So we turn to Eddie Schwartz, who is the acting president of the Songwriters Association of Canada. He's in Nashville at the moment. Eddie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
How did you guys come up with this notion?
Basically, we were in conversations with the government of Canada, who informed us that they had heard what other parties in the music industry were proposing for solutions to the problem of music file sharing on the internet. And they listened to the labels and others, and they felt that they weren't hearing any solutions. So they sort of came to us and said, what have you guys got?
Yeah.
We sat down with a group of songwriters from across the country. We reached out to songwriters in the United States. We talked to people at the Songwriters Guild of America. We talked to futurists. We talked to publishers. And over the course of really a number of months, we developed the proposal as it now stands.
The first thing that struck me when I was reading this proposal is it sounds a lot like the old Betamax VHS tax that was proposed when those forms were coming in for video.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I mean, I'm not entirely comfortable with the word tax. It's one of those red button words that really, create an instant negative impression on people. I think it's more, I mean, the way we look at it is a licensing fee. To me, the analogy that I think holds up has some more to do with performing rights. And if you understand the way broadcast works and how people like me, songwriters, get paid from broadcast, basically what happens is organizations like ASCAP in the United States, they go to broadcasters and they say, you will pay us a small fee. That small fee goes into a pot. And performing rights societies keep track of what songs are being played on the radio. And quarterly, they say, okay, well, look, your songs were played this number of times. Therefore, you would be entitled to this percentage of the pool. So that's a very, a very rational, reasonable, I think, way of dealing with broadcast. The way you could look at peer-to-peer and other technologies like that is it's kind of back to the idea of narrowcasting, which is where you have individuals really communicating with each other. So really what we're saying is that the end user should be paying a license fee, which would, again, go into a pool and be distributed to the people whose music is being file shared.
I noticed that the Canadian Recording Industry Association president has been quoted as saying that, he thinks of this as a pipe dream or a quick fix. He's reluctant to be involved with this because he doesn't see it as a workable solution. I mean, how are you going to break down some of the resistance to this plan?
Some people in the broadcast industry, I'm sure you guys are included in this, love to find the most controversial quotes and use those, to set parties up against each other. And I don't know that I'm going to take the bait. I think Graham Henderson and the large labels, I think they have a problem. And rather than getting into a headbutting exercise with Graham or anybody else, I personally think that our proposal would do them tremendous benefit.
I was just saying before we got on the air here, Mr. Schwartz, that I think the proposal is too smart for its own good, that it is actually a workable solution. So why would the record industry want to embrace
yeah,
it?
Exactly.
The record industry is going down the toilet as we speak. It seems to me that they need to do something. There would seem to be a sense of urgency about implementing a plan like this, because otherwise in 2 years from now, these organizations might not even be here. I mean, wouldn't you say?
Well, amen. I think what you're saying is a conclusion that they will inevitably reach. Again, we think that this proposal is tremendously beneficial. We don't bring it forward because we're anti, record label. I personally, I've been able to make a living over the course of my career because of large labels. But that day, I think we all agree, is past. I think the genie is out of the bottle. It's not going away. And why don't we just monetize activity? That's the future to me. Of all the arts, probably ultimately, and
sure.
I think the music business is just the first one down the pike for obvious reasons.
Mm. We're talking to Eddie Schwartz, the acting president of the Songwriters Association of Canada. They have this really interesting plan for a fee, be about $5 Canadian every month on your wireless and internet account, to have access to basically any music on the net. Eddie, the one thing I wanted to go back to is you made the comparison to the broadcast organizations like BMI, ASCAP, CSAC, as performing rights organizations that collect revenue for artists based on how many times their songs have played. Mm-hmm. Greg and I have talked to a lot of people from those organizations, had some of them on the show. The one flaw would seem to be they measure it by they take an hour or a day or a week representing what an average station plays. The problem is, there may be this great bluegrass show that's only on Sunday nights. And, Madonna gets a lot of money from her performing rights organization, but the little guy doesn't necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I totally agree with you. Now, we're an organization of songwriters, and we know what most people don't realize. The vast majority of people who do what we do for a living, songwriters, artists, don't make a lot of money. We wouldn't have gone forward with a plan that we didn't think could cover everybody. So the good news is there are third-party organizations. One of them that we've been talking to and working with is called Big Champagne, and Big Champagne works out of Los Angeles. And that it's their sole job is to monitor peer-to-peer and other kinds of file-sharing technologies on the Internet.
Mm.
They right now are convinced that they are getting no less than 70%. In other words, what ASCAP and BMI does is a survey, right? They take a small sample, and then they, mathematically amp it up to supposedly cover all the activity.
Right.
What we're talking about is a census where you literally get to count virtually every single file that's shared, and that's very important to us. It's a really crucial point, but I think we're at the point technologically where we can say we can do that or we can come so close to doing that. I mean, I'm sure there'll always be somebody who says, hey, my song's being file shared six times last month and I didn't get paid. So I'm not saying we have 100% coverage, but I think we're going to get close enough that, it's going to be good for the vast majority of people who make music.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much, Eddie, for talking to Sound Opinions.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Greg, that is from the first and last J Records album by Taylor Hicks, one of the big American Idol winners. Just broke the other day that he has been dropped by J Records, which is the label run by Clive Davis, longtime record industry guru, has been a big supporter of all the American Idols, but not Hicks. Hicks sold respectably well with that album, but it wasn't enough. He just didn't have the staying power for Clive Davis to keep him on. What's more, 6 months ago, Ruben Studdard, who made three records for Jay, was quietly dropped after the last of those, the third. They say that the same thing may be happening soon to Jordan Sparks. So what we're seeing here is American Idol about to come back to TV next week for its 7th season. Going to be more popular than ever, according to many TV critics, because there's nothing else to watch on TV. The Writers Guild of America's on strike. No taped programming. Dramas, comedies are not premiering. And all there is, you know, reality TV.
The important distinction here, Jim, is that the TV show is still immensely popular. It's like watching a train wreck. It is in that category of must-see TV for a lot of people because it has this peculiar fascination with watching amateurs try to sing these classic songs.
But that's not translating to buying their albums.
Exactly. With the exceptions. I mean, Carrie Underwood and Chris Daughtry were two of the biggest selling artists of 2007, and they are American Idol graduates. And right now, Carrie Underwood appears to be a real bedrock of Nashville and country music. It remains to be seen whether Daughtry can continue his success, but right now he's the biggest selling rock act in America. The question is, Jim, what is the half-life of these performers?
Right.
I mean, is it one album? Is it three albums? Right now we're seeing that after one or two albums, the public loses interest really quickly. That's from Radiohead's new album, In Rainbows. Not so new in the fact that we have been talking about it for months. It was released as a digital download on Radiohead's website in October, Jim. Got a lot of media attention then because they made it basically available for any price that consumers chose to pay for it, including for free. So for 3 months, this record has been available on the internet, but it finally made it into music stores this week as a physical CD. And guess what? It ended up debuting at number one in the country, selling 122,000 copies. That makes four albums in a row that have debuted in the top five, even though they've been available as digital downloads, sometimes illicitly, for months ahead of their release. However, when they made this experiment on their Radiohead.com website to release the record to whoever wanted it and pay whatever price they wanted, they didn't release any data. But this guy did.
Greg, you know that song. It's Sunday Bloody Sunday by U2, but it's being covered by the poet and rapper Saul Williams, working with producer Trent Reznor, a track from Williams' third album, The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Niggy Tardust. Of course, a reconfiguration of the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust, the David Bowie concept album. Williams' concept is nothing less than the state of the African-American community. It's heavy stuff musically. It's interesting stuff coming on the heels of Reznor's album last year, Year Zero. Now, Reznor did a lot of interesting things on the net to make people aware of Year Zero. With Saul Williams' record, they decided to pretty much follow what Radiohead did. As Reznor wrote on his blog, a quick history, Saul makes a great record that I produce. We can't find the right home at a major label. We decide to release it ourselves digitally. Radiohead charged people whatever people thought it was worth. We've seen some estimates on that, that 85% of people who downloaded that music paid, and apparently the average was about $10. But we've seen nothing definitive. That could be completely false. Radiohead has not said. Reznor, however, has. This experiment with Saul Williams, apparently only 18.3% of the users who downloaded the album paid $5. Now, you could download it for free with a relatively lo-fi MP3, or you could pay $5 for one of the more high-fidelity, there were three different formats, one of the more hi-fi versions. But only less than 20% of the people who paid. This disappointed Reznor. He wrote on his blog, I'm not sure what I was expecting, but that percentage seems disheartening.
Yes, and it's great that Reznor is being so transparent about this process. I wish Radiohead was. I'm curious as heck what the numbers were for Radiohead. But Reznor has given us a window into what this might mean for business opportunities. He's disappointed that only 18% of those people paid for the record. But get this, Jim. Saul Williams' 2004 record on a major label,
yeah,
with marketing and all that stuff behind it, sold less than 34,000 copies. With this record, over 150,000 people downloaded the record. 150,000 people who may have never heard about this record because this guy never gets radio airplay.
Right.
That sets up a great base for Saul Williams to go on tour later this year.
No, absolutely. And he probably never got a dime from any of the records he's made anyway, but he is an incendiary live performer. People who see him have their minds blown and suddenly become fans. He's in a better place today than he was. But let's talk about the record. We're going to play a track called Convict Colony from on the inevitable rise and liberation of Niggy Tartus, which is really as much Trent Reznor as it is Saul Williams. Here it is on Sound Opinions.
Convict Colony from Saul Williams' new record, The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Niggy Tartus. This is a man who thinks no small thoughts, Jim. He is talking about the black experience in North America. That song talking about being ripped from the motherland and living as basically a convict.
Yeah.
The way he sees the black experience of the last 200 plus years in America. You know, he gets more personal as the album goes along. And I have to say, I love some of the more personal stuff at the end of the record. It's not this necessarily this political manifesto all the way through. But the defining feature of this record, not only Saul Williams' voice, but the production by Trent Reznor. Trent Reznor is scuzzing up every beat he can find and giving him this really dirty percussive background. A lot of the songs basically come down to voice and percussion, very distorted, with occasional blurts of synthesizer and some other instruments in there, but generally a voice and percussion type of record. Is a twisted take on hip-hop. And I'm glad to say it does not fall anywhere near the realm of a, you know, that awful genre called rap rock that emerged in the mid to late 90s. It's really sort of creating a genre of its own. It's somewhere between spoken word, somewhere between hip-hop. There's a little bit of industrial in there. They've defined a kind of a their own sound here, Saul Williams and Trent Reznor.
No, absolutely. Well, you know, Reznor once again proves his mettle as a producer, because Williams' first record was produced by none other than Rick Rubin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a third-tier sort of Rage Against the Machine thing.
Yeah.
Because Williams is primarily a poet, an actor, a screenwriter. He came to hip-hop fairly late in the game. And, you know, if you can't make a really interesting record with Rick Rubin, you know, here he is, a great live performer on record he hasn't translated. I wish I discovered this album sooner. It came out in November. It didn't really start to make a lot of news in the United States until the last couple of weeks, when Reznor began writing about how disappointed he was with this release. It would have been a real contender for my album of the year, because sonically and conceptually, it is absolutely mind-blowing. And again, it's out there on the net. You don't have to take our word for it. You can go download it for free. It does underscore one of the problems with this new means of distribution. You can put out your record and arguably have more people than ever hear it, but how do they know it's there? I mean, on a twist on that old canard, if you put a CD out and nobody hears it, did it really happen?
Exactly.
I love this. This is a buy-it album for sure.
Yeah, you know, there's not a lot of hooks here. I mean, this guy's not really concerned about melody at all, or choruses or things like that. But this is a heavy-duty record, and it's kind of a record, the more you listen to it, the more you get out of it. I love records like that that sustain themselves over extended listening periods. So I'd have to say, you know, Trent Reznor wants $5 for this record.
$5!
I think it's worth $5.
That's like a grande latte, right?
Exactly. Coming up on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we welcome the stars of the movie Once, the band Swell Season, for an interview and a live performance.
We are broken instruments, burst wide open, smashed and bent. Not what you'd expect from these city streets. Who serves to protect the orchestra in me?
conductor, conductor, I feel electricity. Conductor, conductor, can you bring out the song in me?
Instrument, instrument.
You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, and we are here in the Jim and Kay Mabey studio with Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova, otherwise known as the Swell Season, also the stars of the indie hit movie Once. I called you guys the Jay-Z and the Beyonce of indie cinema in the paper the other day. You're the new stars.
I read that. I was going to ask them what they thought of that, if they bothered to read their press.
That's right. So we're going to call Glenn Jay-Z, and we're going to call Marketa Beyonce.
I want to be Chris Christopherson. Can we change it?
Sure. Why not?
Does that make you Barbara Streisand?
I wonder.
Marketa?
That's all right. Barbara's beautiful.
Anyway, we're glad to have you here. And I guess the best place to start is, you know, you put out a terrific record last year that kind of swam under the mainstream radar. Many of those songs ended up in the movie Once. And now here you are playing a sold-out tour. People heard those songs, loved those songs. Movie was made for under $200,000. It was like a homemade movie. Ended up becoming a hit at the Sundance Festival, ended up grossing $12 million plus and still growing. Glenn, you've been doing this a long time. Where's your head at right now with the, what's happened in the last year?
I must admit, I'm blown away, and everything has been it's been an absolute whirlwind, to be honest. And I mean, even the Sundance thing was a kind of a skin of our teeth thing. Because, I mean, John sent this film to, he sent it to Toronto, he sent it to Sundance, he sent it to a bunch of festivals, and everyone refused it. We got the official refusal letter from Sundance and everyone else. And
John Carney, the director of the movie.
John, the director, yeah. And when we showed this film for the first time at a small screening in Galway in Ireland, and afterwards we met this guy, and he said it was the first time me and Mara seen the film. We were very proud of it, and, you know, thanking John outside. And John said, that's probably the only time you'll see this on a big screen. We were just really glad we saw it. And this man came up and he says, hello, my name is, and his name is John Nine. He said, my name is John Nine. I'm here on holidays. I saw there was a film playing. I went in. I'd actually heard your band, The Frames, which was nice for me to see on the screen. And I work for Sundance, and I'd love to take a copy of this film over and possibly, you know, give it to them. And we didn't tell him that we'd already been refused. We were just like, yeah, sure, here, take the DVD. So he took the DVD and we got accepted into Sundance. And so I have to say that since then, you know, since we went over there in January, it's been, I can't believe it's less than a year. It's still less than a year ago that we've been there, and we've been, you know, the amount of kind of work we've done, not necessarily work, but the amount of running around or the amount of how busy we've been since then It feels like about 3 years.
Marketa, you were 17, 18 when this film was being shot. This is your first experience, obviously, on a movie set. What was that like, being sort of cast into this role as an actress? I mean, you're a classically trained pianist, grew up in the Czech Republic. How did that, you being on this in front of the camera, how did that feel?
It felt unusual for sure. I felt a bit awkward for a few days. You know, whenever there's a camera around, you feel a bit self-conscious in some way. And then after a few days, you just get used to it. And then you forget it's there. And you find it much easier to just be natural around it.
You know, the experience making the film was one thing, but it's all of this stuff that's been much more, I guess, life-changing. Mm. But, you know, the coming out and being, you know, we traveled across America in a bus last April. And one thing that one should never become in life is media savvy. I find myself in a position where I'm actually able to talk, and I don't like that. I don't like the fact that I know what to say in an interview. I have to say that it's kind of right now, I definitely need a holiday, because I want to go back to being innocent, where it's like, what? What do you mean?
So you were just spouting the sound bites.
Well, not yeah, and trying to avoid it the whole time, and trying to get out, constantly trying to backtrack and get into
it. Don't make that easy by asking the same darn question over
and
over.
Well, there you go.
I mean, the main thing I want to know right now is why the heck you got three gaping holes in the middle of your acoustic guitar. I mean, you could probably buy 20 or 40 today.
Haven't been asked that one before.
See, there we go. So I'll do my part, you do yours. Why the heck you got a guitar that looks like it got run over by a bus, Glenn?
I've just played it a lot. I've played it quite hard, and recently we were in Japan. Actually, we were in Japan a few weeks ago, myself and Mar, which was another incredible experience.
I'm sure.
And when we were there, I took out my guitar and we were playing this small concert in a town square. And I said, actually, I just realized my guitar is home, because my guitar is a Takamine guitar. And I realized it was, you know, because it's a Japanese-made guitar. I was like, oh, my guitar is home. And they said, it's funny you should say that, because Mr. Takamine himself is here. And this man came out on stage, this elderly man, and he had a guitar case, and he gave me this brand new, you know, handmade version of this guitar. And I was very thankful, of course. I was blown away. And then afterwards they said, well, the reason they gave it to you is because, you know, they're ashamed of the fact that you're using such a...
The only part of that guitar that isn't defiled is the headstock that says Takamine. The rest of it really looks like it. We got to put a picture of this on the web. Really looks like it got hit by a hand grenade.
Well, I have to say, though, watching Glenn perform the other night with Marquetta, you know, the intensity, even though you may say you're going through the motions a little bit or, you know, feeling a little bit jaded already, there was no sense of a guy sort of phoning it in the other night. It seems like you were able to get into that space where you perform those songs in a way that, like, I think this guy's going to blow up and his guitar along with it. And I'm amazed that the guitar is actually still in one piece if you perform those songs at that level every night.
Well, thanks very much. I mean, it definitely in front of an audience, I find it very easy to go to the moment. I find it very easy to when there's an audience, because members of the public are very, very easy to tune into and very easy to enjoy. You know, whereas what I suppose what kind of freaked me out on that tour was that we traveled all over the States. We did breakfast shows every morning. Like, we did literally 40 interviews a day. It was insane.
Oh,
and so by the end of it, it was kind of like, so you've made a film, and they point a mic at you, and it's like, and somehow you know what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what bothers me. I think in life, one should always be... one should always keep a sense of wonder in their life. And that's why I'm actually saying this, because this is fresh for me. I need to say this, even though it might sound a little bit like, oh my God, this guy is, you know, is ungrateful. I'm totally grateful. I can't believe this has happened. I've been in a band for 17 years. I've been chipping away, and now something's happened, and it's been like a 17-year overnight success, if you like. Mm-hmm. And I'm acutely aware of the fact that in 1 year from now, Once will have been a film that happened a year ago.
Yeah.
And I hope... that what you know, having toured and having played our gigs, that a small modicum of those of percentage of those people who came to see us this year and who filled those rooms, that's the oddest thing for me, is standing in a room full of people and knowing that there's a percentage of people who are just kind of going to see the once people perform. And I guess I'm hoping in my heart of hearts that these people are going to enjoy the music.
And, yeah, so you have to be good every night
and stick
to
around.
Get them to come back.
Exactly.
But why don't we have a song? Would you guys indulge us?
Yeah, sure. What do you want to do, Mar? Let's do Falling Slowly. Let's get us into it. 2, 3, 4.
Rain.
Wow. What a treat. Falling Slowly by Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova. You're listening to Sound Opinions. We're here at the Jim and Kay Maybe studio with the Swell Season, this wonderful duo. Now, Glenn, that was a song that first appeared, Falling Slowly, on a Frames album, right?
Yeah.
Take us through how it got from there into the movie, if you would, because it's such a centerpiece of the film, and I think it's the one that first sweeps everybody off their feet when they fall in love with this movie.
Well, thanks. John first came to me maybe 2.5 years ago with this idea for a film that he had, and he had Cillian Murphy playing the main role. And he had asked me to give him some songs, which for me as a songwriter was the, you know, best thing I could have gotten. Like I said earlier on, you're struggling away, you're doing your thing. And so the opportunity to write a bunch of songs for a film is just a great gig to get, if you like.
I got to inject in here. I mean, you started your career as a teenager yourself, busking on the streets of Dublin. When you're sitting on the street corner playing whatever people, you know, want to hear when they throw a few coins in your case, you know, it probably seems a world away to someday write songs for a movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely. And especially what was especially weird about it was that the character was maybe 70, 80% based on my own life as well, which when I got the part to play, when I was asked to play that role, really weirded me out, to be honest, because I was like, wow, this is so close to my own. It's like me doing a biopic of myself, a third through the story of my life. So it was a very weird thing for me to sort of do, and that's a whole other conversation we could have, I guess, at some point. But so for me getting the chance to write the songs for this film was very exciting. So I went to work straight away, and actually, ironically, I finished the song with Mar before either of us were involved in the project, and then gave the song to John. John loved it. And I, to be honest with you, the reason it's on a Frames record and the reason it's on the Swell Season record, the reason the Swell Season record was made at all was basically us recording a collection of songs. Basically, we hadn't got the money to record these songs for John. We had the money to basically home record them, which is fine. You just stick a microphone in front of yourself. So we went to the studio. We had an opportunity to have, we had 4 paid days in a studio to write 2 songs for a Czech movie that a friend of ours was making, and he wanted us to submit 2 Frame songs. So I said to him, okay, if we have this four days in a studio and you want these 2 songs, we'll record them for you. But if anything else that we do in the studio, can we keep? And he said, sure. So our deal was, you get the songs for free, we get to keep everything else we record.
Yeah.
So we knocked out 2 Frame songs for Jan Trebek, this Czech director, great director. So we had these recordings for John, a full album of, here it is, John, here's all the songs for your film. But we didn't think once would ever come out. So rather than say, like, you know, Glenn Hansard, Marketa Irglova, the songs from once, not knowing the film would ever come out, we decided to call it The Swell Season, which was a book we were both reading by Josef Skorecki, who was a Czech writer. We both loved, and we just decided to call ourselves a band name. And then when the Frames were making our album, the lads in the band were like, man, we should really put that song on the Frames record because it's, you know, it's a really good song. And the Swell Season record had sold 300 copies. Nobody had bought it. It was one of those weird under the radar records that comes out. You know how it is. You put out a record, sometimes it'll catch people's imagination, sometimes it won't. This record sold nothing. So I thought, why waste a tune? Put it on the Frames record and, you know, a few extra people are going to buy it. And so the irony is that those 2 songs, When Your Mind's Made Up and Falling Slowly, have actually ended up on 3 albums that we released this year, which for me is a little embarrassing. But when you consider when you consider the headspace we were in when we were putting those records together, it actually kind of makes sense.
But, you know, the beauty of that song and of the movie in general is that the story is told through those songs. I was blown away by the fact that it was complete songs. And you're telling the story of these characters. It's like a musical, but it's a cool musical. It's not like these people break out in song in the middle of the street, you know, for no reason. It's like you go into this music store. This relationship is just starting to unfold. You've just met each other. It's a little awkward. You don't even know that she can play piano yet. You see, hey, she's okay. I'm going to, you know, let's play a song. And Marquette is there kind of comping along with you.
This is in C, yeah?
Yeah, okay, I can see that.
Okay. So it goes, da, it goes, da, 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 da. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And then there's a bit in it. Can you do that?
And about halfway through, I was just like, I've never seen anything like this in a movie where you can just see this relationship and this couple getting closer through the performance of this song.
Yeah. And then the chorus, so you have those 2 bits.
Mm-hmm.
And the chorus goes, That's it. Perfect. Brilliant.
Marquette, I guess, can I ask you, what stage of the relationship were you in at that point in terms of that song? I mean, it literally seemed like you were learning it in the moment. Obviously, that's not the case, but how were you able to sort of get that moment of, oh my God, we're doing something together, and it's this chemistry that's occurring on the screen at that time?
Well, I mean, people keep talking about some kind of chemistry that we have together, but, you know, it doesn't mean that we see it. You know, we're not aware of some chemistry when we play together. We just play together and have a good time doing it, but we don't see any sparks between us, you know. So we just basically did what we did when we were writing the song, and John caught it on camera, and he saw what you saw, I guess, because he was an observer, as the audience are, but we don't, you know, it doesn't mean that we see it, if that makes sense. We just play music, and what you see is not necessarily what we see.
I think it's great to have the camera there as sort of a voyeur into that process, though. Yeah. And I was in a theater with an audience, a very mixed audience. I mean, people from their 20s into their 60s. And everybody was there just with their jaw on the floor by the end of that. It was just like, this was a really moving testimonial to how music can create a storyline and get you involved in these characters.
And it's funny, with this scene, what it was that John had seen, when John auditioned Mar, there was no script, there was no script reading, she didn't audition for him in the traditional sense. She came and played some piano for him. I got Mar over from Czech and I said, look, my friend John's looking for an actress. He's looking for a girl who plays Eastern European, who plays piano and sings. Now, that's you. So if you come over to Dublin, I'll introduce you, play him some piano, maybe read him some lines. And Mark came over and we sat down with John, and John had brought his small video camera with him, I think in order to audition Mar, but ended up just filming me and Mar playing this song. Mm. And just before we start playing, myself and Mar were like, okay, so first verse, and then we go into the bridge back. Because, you know, the song was still, you know, I guess we were still figuring it out. Mm-hmm. And John was like, this is great. Whatever you're doing here is what I really want to get when we shoot it. And when we shoot it, I'd love you to try to remember where you are now and try to reenact how you put the song together in the first place. And so John's fascination was, you know, he says, I love to turn on the TV and see some guy painting a picture. I love what happens as a few lines that then turns into, like, suddenly there's some perspective, and then he puts a little white strip across the side, and suddenly you've got sunlight hitting something. And he says, I think people are really fascinated by watching others work. Mm. And he says, that would be wonderful to try get that in a film, to try get that moment of just watching people actually work.
Yeah. Now, Marquette, you have an interesting role in the film in that you're kind of pushy. You're kind of bringing this guy, this kind of sad, lonely guy, out of his shell, and you're challenging him a little bit. Obviously, there's been a lot of parallels between what your relationship is like in real life and what this movie's like, but how does that parallel your relationship to Glenn as a songwriting collaborator?
Well, I guess we do take that attitude toward each other because we're very close. We don't, you know, we can say things as they are. We don't have to tiptoe around each other, and we can just be straight with each other and through that, we motivate each other, and we, you know, I won't say that I'm as bossy, you know, if somebody told me I don't want to talk to you, I really don't think I'd still be standing there 10 minutes later.
Mm-hmm. One of the first times I met Mar, Mar's father had invited me to go stay at the house, because basically myself and Mar's father became friends, and he invited me to go stay in the Czech Republic maybe 6 years ago. And I remember I was sitting up in the room and I was recording something, and I knew Mar played piano, so I asked her to come up and would she just basically play a few simple lines over the top of something I was doing. And I remember one of the first things she said to me was this lyric, you know, because she had the headphones on, she was listening, she says, this lyric you're singing, did this happen to you? And I was like, well, which one? And I listened, and I was like, well, you know, it kind of did. You know, it's kind of poetic license. She was like, what do you mean, like, poetic? And I said, well, you know, I'm using metaphor to make my point. And she was like, so this didn't happen to you? And I said, well, no, like, not exactly. So this didn't happen in your life? And I said, no. She said, well, why are you saying it? Mm. And I remember that was one of the, like, I remember, like, knowing that moment that, like, man, this girl's, like, she's straight ahead. I mean, you know, I've been in my band for years, and nobody, you know, none of the guys really, and actually sometimes the lads are like, oh, I never knew that lyric, you know, like 15 years later. It's just we're not listening to that part of it, whereas Mara was totally tuned into it.
All right, another song, Marquette and Glenn?
Yeah. Should we do Once? Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Part of me has died and won't return, and part of me wants to hide. Heart that's burned. Once I knew where to look for you. Once but not anymore. Hear the sirens call me home. Hear the sirens call me home. Hear the sirens call me home. Hear the sirens call me. Talk to you once, but that was before. Once I would have laid down and died for you. Once but not anymore. Sirens call me home. Hear the sirens call me home. Hear the sirens call me.
That was the title song from the Once soundtrack. Glenn Hansard, Marketa Erglova, The Swell Season. Great having you guys on Sound Opinions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's time we give it up and figure out what's stopping us from breathing easy and talk.
You can check out photos and bonus tracks from our session with The Swell Season at soundopinions.org. We'll be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with Greg Kot's Desert Island Jukebox pick.
and take it tight. Save yourself. The little cracks they escalated. Before you know it, it's too late for me.
We were shipwrecked together.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That music heralds our Desert Island Jukebox segment. Greg Kot, you have the first pick of 2008.
Thank you, Jim. It's an honor. And I must say that I was inspired by the visit from Glenn and Marquette of The Swell Season. I like collaborations. I like songwriters who complement each other. I like the energy that that creates. And I think that movie captured what it's like to write songs together. And so I started thinking about, okay, what bands do I like where this kind of collaborative thing is going on? Obviously, most bands have a single songwriter, and the band is sort of like helping this guy out, or gal. But I think some of the strongest bands of all time have had two or three great songwriters vying, competing to write the best song, or in some cases collaborating. We can think of many famous examples of that, from the Beatles to Husker Du, where people talk about these bands to this day. But I think one of the bands that succeeded in doing this collaborative songwriting approach, writing great songs, and really doesn't get the due that they're owed, is a band called Lush from the UK. Started in the late 80s as a collaborative band between two primary songwriters, Mickey Beregnier and Emma Anderson. Mickey and Emma didn't really write together, but their songs sort of answered each other in their records. And as they went along, they made four or five fabulous records, a bunch of EPs. They were part of that British shoegazer movement, big swells of guitar defining that sound. Much better known bands in that genre are bands like My Bloody Valentine, Your Beloved Ride, several
Slow
others.
Slow Dive. You know I love the shoegazer.
Absolutely. Lush was in that category, but never really got their due with those other bands. And I think one of the reasons was that they always had a pop thing going on as well. To my mind, I saw them as sort of a middle ground between that heavy guitar sound of My Bloody Valentine and those cooing female vocals as defined by the Cocteau Twins.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful combination. I love that sound. Those fragile female vocals melding with those big cyclonic guitars. That is just a killer, killer sound. And I think it was defined best on their debut album in the United States in the early 90s called Gala, which was just basically a combination of their early UK EPs. The best of those EPs was produced by Robin Guthrie.
Of Cocteau Twins.
One of the founding members of Cocteau Twins, exactly. And I think they got the sound just right on this song that I'm going to play. Here's those guitars, here are those voices in beautiful harmony on a song called Deluxe. It's on Sound Opinions.
Some sights you see, some sights you feel.
That was my Desert Island Jukebox pick, the first of 2008. It was Lush with Deluxe.
Great choice, Mr. Cott. Got some thank yous to say. Our session with The Swell Season was recorded by Mary Gaffney and Sarah Toulouse, and Sound Opinions was produced, as always, by our ace team of Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, Robin Lynn, and Dave Mahler, the intern, with executive production and fearless leadership from Tori Southside Malatia, who, I gotta say, has not been the same ever since Ruben Studdard was dropped.
Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling goes the telephone. Ting-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a goes my heart. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling goes the telephone, and I know that the fireworks will start.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic, so now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hey guys, this is Jim from the south side of Chicago, calling in response to the show from this past weekend with your in-studio guests, the Fiery Furnaces. They sound to me like every band that I had to put up with in the Boston goth music scene who had a huge chip on their shoulder about proving that they had a genuine English degree and making the music that they did as complicated as possible and as literary as possible and in the long run as unlistenable as possible in an effort to be, I don't know, as indie as possible or something. But big pile of noise, not at all interesting, big waste of time. Sorry it was on the air.
Not a kid, it didn't happen. I consulted my Egyptian grammar. On page 3333 was the hieroglyph for motorcycle hammer.
I combined this with a leatherback shell as I felt I was instructed. I Xeroxed it and posted it down by the bike lock opposite the Oriental Institute. Maybe another world entity would see it and pass it on to those responsible.
Hey guys, so I'm touring the nation and I'm catching up on all my Sound Opinion shows. Every week you guys rail against the bigwigs who shake down the people for, you know, illegal downloading. Most artists aren't bigwigs and most artists aren't on bigwig record labels. You know, in fact, I'm an indie artist and I've spent my life developing the value of my intellectual property and of my master recordings. And it's my legal right to be able to name my price point. The audacity of your opinion, I think, is illuminated mostly by the fact that there's these digital download services where you can pay a paltry sum and get a ton of free music every month that's totally restriction-free. You can put it on any device. When I get paid from them, I get pennies per song. Pennies. So what you're basically advocating is like this weird reverse Robin Hood thing you got going on. It's stealing from the trenches of what is the pulse of the indie music scene. So you can hold your position, but I think you got to call it what it is. It's stealing from the poor. Now, I'd also like to note that you guys are critics, and I'm guessing there's like 40 or 50 years combined of you guys being music critics, and that's 40 or 50 years of you guys getting all your music free at the expense of the artist and the label. I just think your position is a little tenuous. So that said, I love the show. Love the show. Totally addicted. I'll be listening more. Willie, signing off. I live in Laurel Canyon, California. Talk soon. Bye.
Hi, this is Gavin Jackson, and I just wanted to say that I couldn't agree more with your glowing review of Lupe Fiasco's The Cool. As a college junior in Milwaukee, I've seen the poverty contrasted with the excesses of college life, and honestly, I've always been aware of the social problems, but it never stopped me from trying to feel good and doing a lot of the things that The Cool actually says is bad. It just puts you into limbo. And if any piece of art, I should say, any album, any artwork, any movie would affect me personally and my drug use, it would be The Cool.
Don't you know that I run this place and I've begun this race? Must I rerun this pace? I'm the reason it's become this way, and their love for it is the reason I have become this praise.
This album I listen to just to stay strong when, you know, I think about using narcotics. Basically, it's one of the best albums of the year, and it's an album I'll always hold close to my heart, and I thank you for reviewing it, and I thank you guys for introducing me to hip-hop, because I basically never listened to even James Brown before you guys reviewed Mad Villain, and I thank you guys for pointing me in the right direction. So keep it up. It's good work. Thanks, guys. Bye.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on sound opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with sound opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.